Hello, welcome to Dr. M's Women and Children First Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. M. And this week, I sit down with Dr. Stan Gabrishevsky from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia to discuss allergies from multiple angles. Dr. Gabrishevsky graduated from Princeton University with a degree in molecular biology before attending Columbia University for his medical degree, as well as a PhD in cellular, molecular, and biomedical studies. He then went on to complete his pediatric residency and is a senior fellow in the allergy immunology department at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia currently, where he teaches and performs research in the lab of Dr. David Hall. His research is focused on better understandings of the epidemiologic and immunologic features among pediatric allergic disorders, in particular the food allergies, IgE-mediated food allergy, and eosinophilic esophagitis. In this conversation, Stan and I sit down to discuss his recent paper in pediatrics entitled Patterns in the Development of Pediatric Allergy. The article is a much-needed look at the true prevalence of allergy and allergic disease in children. We discuss the statistics as well as the thoughts behind the why this allergic march and allergies in general are continuing on the current trajectory. The upstream reasons are very important to me and are hard to tease out, but worthy of discussion and exploration as we do. So please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Stan Gabrishevsky. Well, Stan Gabrishevsky from the upper area there in Pennsylvania, you're at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show to talk all things allergy immunology.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on your podcast.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure. And this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. When I started private practice at this practice that I'm at years ago, I had run an asthma clinic for a long time, and asthma and allergy tends to be something that I'm very passionate about. And, you know, from the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, lately the reports are showing that, you know, we're talking upwards of $18, $19, $20 billion in spend every year on allergic type diseases. So it's a major problem for society. And your work recently published in Pediatrics last July really finally, frankly, gave us some concrete details as to what we're actually seeing from a numerical perspective. Are we seeing more allergies? And what does that look like? So I'm going to turn you loose and let you sort of speak to the work you did, and then we can do a little more of a dive into the anthropologic history and why we think we're seeing what we're seeing, and we'll go down that road.
Absolutely. That sounds like a great plan. So just to give you a little bit of background of who I am and what I do, I am currently a clinical fellow in allergy and immunology at CHOP. I'm also a member of the laboratory of Dr. David Hill at CHOP and Penn. And I am a clinical translational scientist. My current research interests include looking at patterns of pediatric allergy and studying the relationship in particular between IgE-mediated food allergy and eosinophilic esophagitis, although admittedly I am interested in food allergy in general. And the work that I'm going to talk about represents a collaboration with researchers at CHOP and Penn, including members of the Division of Allergy and Immunology and the Clinical Features Center, who together have expertise in allergy and immunology, informatics, and epidemiology. And the reason we did this study that was recently published in Pediatrics is that we wanted to provide a current description of the patterns of diagnosis of allergies over the last two decades. So roughly between 2000 and 2020, before the COVID pandemic started. And this is an important area of interest because we know, as you alluded to in your introduction, that when allergies are not fully treated, they can have negative effects on children's quality of life. They can make it difficult to sleep, to focus, do well in school, and they can cause anxiety, especially for families with children with life-threatening conditions like anaphylactic food allergy. And this can certainly make it difficult for children and their families to enjoy their day-to-day life, to say the least. And to improve how clinicians can diagnose and treat allergies in children, it's really important that we have an accurate understanding of how widespread they are and why some children are more likely to develop allergies over others. Because this information has the potential to inform research efforts, funding, and public health measures. And an important part of our rationale for doing this study is that so far, the majority of studies that have studied the patterns of allergies in children have relied on surveys that are completed by families And as you can imagine, this is not an entirely accurate or even fair approach, as it expects families to know and remember diagnostic information about their children's allergies. And so we used a complementary approach. We looked at diagnostic information entered by clinicians in the electronic health records across different practices within the United States. So the database that we used in our study was the American Academy of Pediatrics CIRSQUARE database. This stands for Comparative Effectiveness Research through Collaborative Electronic Reporting. And this is a consortium of practices, multi-state, multi-health institution, consortium of practices in the United States. And we used diagnostic and prescription information in the electronic health record of nearly 220,000 children to study the age of incidence, the prevalence, and also comorbidity patterns of allergic conditions. So in other words, we looked at when and how frequently these conditions are being diagnosed and which allergic conditions tend to co-occur. And in terms of what our major findings were, I think one of the first important take-home messages is that we observed a pattern in the sequence in which children tended to be diagnosed with allergies. This is a concept known as the allergic march. I think it might be helpful to define the diseases that we looked at in our study, because I imagine that the audience for your podcast can be quite broad. So the first disease that we looked at is atopic dermatitis or eczema. This is an allergic condition of the skin. And it's characterized by itching and scratching. And sometimes these rashes get so unbearable that children are scratching so much, they get bleeding, they can have skin color changes. And when untreated, it increases risk for skin infections. The second condition we looked at is IgE-mediated food allergy. This is another term for anaphylactic food allergy. This is the type of food allergy where clinicians have to prescribe an EpiPen to families. And it results in potentially life-threatening symptoms, which include hives, skin swelling, trouble breathing, vomiting, and sometimes low blood pressure. We also looked at asthma, which is a disorder that leads to constriction of the airways, and results in shortness of breath, cough, wheezing. And we looked at allergic rhinitis. More commonly, you may hear the term seasonal allergies or hay fever. Some have more all year long allergies. These are nasal allergies that lead to congestion, sneezing, itchy, watery eyes. And then the fifth condition we examined is EoE or eosinophilic esophagitis. This is a distinct and emerging food allergy from anaphylactic food allergy that specifically affects the esophagus, and it can cause trouble swallowing, vomiting, and food impactions. So going back to the allergic march, as a whole in our study, children tended to be diagnosed first with atopic dermatitis or eczema. This was followed by IgE-mediated food allergy, and these were then followed by the respiratory allergies, namely asthma and allergic rhinitis, and lastly by eosinophilic esophagitis. So this is the allergic march concept, that overall children tend to develop allergies in a stereotypical sequence with atopic dermatitis and IgE-mediated food allergy tending to occur earlier, and this being followed by the respiratory allergies. And I just want to make the point that the allergic march is a population-level concept. This is, does not mean that every child will develop each of these allergic conditions, but rather it helps us understand when over the course of a child's life these conditions may appear if they are going to progress. Another finding that we observed in our studies that children with certain allergic conditions, they were more likely to develop certain conditions concurrent with other allergic conditions. So just as examples, respiratory allergic conditions, specifically asthma and allergic rhinitis, tended to occur together. And this was also the case for food allergies, namely IgE-mediated food allergy and EoE. And this is helpful information because understanding which allergic conditions tend to occur together is helpful to both clinicians and families, so they can be better informed about when to be on the lookout for the possible development of new allergic conditions. A third interesting finding in our study is that the prevalence of IgE-mediated or anaphylactic food allergy was 4%. And this is approximately half of the prevalence of what has been previously reported in studies that were based on surveys of families rather than looking at diagnostic electronic health record-based information. I think that this discrepancy highlights the importance of clinicians partnering with families in diagnosing food allergies and intolerances. And admittedly, we did only look at IgE-mediated food allergy, and we did not consider conditions like cow's milk protein intolerance, lactose intolerance, for example, food protein-induced enterocolitis. We really were homing in on anaphylactic food allergy for that metric.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of the key point, the key takeaway from your data that I saw was that number one, you guys very clearly defined a profile of disease. So 10% of the children developed atopic dermatitis or eczema, you know, roughly one in 10, that's a pretty high number, right? And then you looked at even more impressive at 13 months of age, one in five or 20% of the children developed asthma. And then a further 20, that's 26 months, one in five or 20% developed allergic rhinitis. So we see this pretty impressive volumetric pattern to the allergic march or the allergic disease phenotype in kids. How do you see that comparing? Because I know when I was in grade school, you know, food allergy, you know, let's say 4%, you know, if we saw a peanut allergy kid in my entire high school career, you know, there've been one kid maybe. So clearly there's been an increased incidence. What's the lay of the land and the belief about how much that increase has occurred, and is it going exponential, or are we still in a linear growth phase?
I think that's a very complicated question to answer. And I did do a little bit of thinking about rates of allergy, you know, decades and even a century ago across different allergic conditions. And I think in trying to answer that question, it is helpful to try to think about the major components of the allergic march. So first of all, just in terms of allergy in general, there are historical descriptions that do recognize the existence of allergic conditions going back as late as the time of Hippocrates and early Chinese empires. But the interest in looking at allergy rates didn't really occur until really the second half of the 20th century. And I suspect that the fact that there was increased interest likely signals that allergies were becoming more common. I don't think it's possible or accurate to try to do rigorous number-to-number comparisons of rates of disease in historic times versus more recently. And I think that's in part because the methodologies that we have available to us now to study disease rates were not available back then. And also there are huge discrepancies in disease definitions. So years ago, people were looking at symptoms, and now we have actual diagnostic information and diagnosis codes. But nevertheless, it has been postulated that there were two major allergy waves that occurred. So first, a respiratory allergy wave as we entered the 20th century for allergic rhinitis, and then a bit later in the second half of the 20th century for asthma. Concurrently, atopic dermatitis was being talked about medically starting in the 1930s. I think for the sake of simplicity, we can say that it was occurring to some degree concurrent with the respiratory allergy wave. And then following the respiratory allergy wave, there was a more recent food allergy wave. And there's been a number of factors that have been sort of postulated as potential reasons for why this happened. A number of lifestyle changes, increased hygiene, increased agricultural practices, which can affect pollen patterns. There's questions about staying indoors more, which in itself is a complicated discussion because, probably we'll talk about later, timing of exposure is also important with early life exposures thought to be protective. Possibly dietary contribution. There has been a shift to more processed foods with less fiber, reduced diversity of foods, increased exposures to pollutants and toxic chemicals, and possible changes in the permeability of the skin. So as a thought exercise, let's consider these large waves that I just talked about. So first wave, part one, Allergic rhinitis began to be described around 1870 in Europe and the US. And that's thought to be in part due to changes in agricultural practices at the time that promoted increased growth and exposure to allergenic pollens. And also at that time, there were also concurrent public hygiene measures being implemented. The awareness of allergic rhinitis at that time seems to have increased exponentially in the early part of the 1900s, more recently plateauing. Currently, it's estimated that allergic rhinitis occurs at a rate of about 10 to 30% of the population. And our statistic in our study fits within that range. We found a rate of about 20%. Results of the National Health Interview Survey in 2021 with a seasonal allergy rate of 19% is also consistent with this. So then we have the second part of this respiratory allergy wave, with asthma being more recognized in the second half of the 20th century, starting in the 1960s. There are initial reports that try to correlate asthma with increased time indoors and potential exposure to perennial or what we call all year long allergens, dust mites, cat, dog, cockroach. There's questions about dietary changes contributing to this asthma wave. As a sort of aside, there is this subset of asthma called obesity-associated asthma, which is associated with higher hospitalization rates and more refractory disease, which begs the question of whether dietary changes could have contributed to this. Exposure to pollutants, maybe increased exposure to potentially harmful substances in the environment, try teasing that out, as hundreds of thousands of new substances have been introduced to the world during the second half of the 20th century. But we do know that smoke and other pollutants can exacerbate asthma. In terms of rates, in one study in the UK, the rate of wheezing over a one-year period in children increased from 10% to up to 30% between 1960 and the early 2000s, suggesting that this truly was a wave in asthma. We probably have reached a plateau in asthma in industrialized countries. And recent national surveys suggest a rate around 10% or so. In our study, we saw a prevalence of about 20%. Rates really do vary depending on the study methodology, the study population. We probably saw a larger rate because our study population was largely urban.
Yeah. So most of the things you're speaking to, I think, are very clear that they're multifactorial. It's like a dike. There may be 20, 30 plugs in there that could be driving the dysfunction that we see of is like you're talking leaky skin, leaky gut, leaky this, leaky that, immune tolerance dysfunction. There's a lot to be said there, but clearly at the center of the whole thing is the immune system and frankly, inflammation. And so inflammation being in general a very good thing if you're trying to fight an infection like a parasite or a natural bacteria that you would be exposed to from 3 million years ago until the recent past, that was the norm. Most people died of infectious diseases. Most people died of things related to that experience. And so we have a genomic profile that's actually set up to handle primarily infections. And then, lo and behold, in the last 100 years, we've shifted many factors, as you stated. Clearly, it's very hard to tease out which one is it, but we've shifted many. And now we're sitting in a soup of difference that says, okay, immune system, how are you going to react to not seeing as many pathogens? And I really wonder what's going to happen with the two-year COVID period in the next generation. But speak to the immune tolerance perspective. What is the natural order of a human when born to develop immune tolerance? And I specifically want to hone this down if we can, sort of like the Stein New England Journal of Medicine paper with the comparison of the Hutterite and Amish genocentric communities, and to your point, translational research, where they took the dust from the homes of the different groups and found one had high levels of endotoxin, the bacterial cell wall debris, and the Hutterite homes did not. And then they gave these dust particles to the mice that were either predisposed to develop asthma. And they found that
the group that had the Hutterite exposure developed asthma, but the group that had the Amish dust exposure did not, positing again that the bacterial exposure in that priming zone, which you're talking about the timing phase, actually shifted how the immune system saw this tolerance. So let's specifically speak to the tolerance piece, because I think that's critical for everyone to understand. If we can't find all of the upstream reasons as to the why or the variables, maybe at least we can understand how tolerance develops. So then we can think about what was naturally supposed to happen and maybe how we've really made that dysfunctional now.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there are several questions at play here. I think one of the essential elements here is a breach in the epithelial barrier. And so there's an important role for skin. And I think we also have to have a discussion about the immune tolerance or aberrations in immune tolerance. And we'll save time for the hygiene hypothesis as well. So just to sort of wrap up my conversation about the rates of allergy, I mentioned that we had a respiratory allergy wave probably atopic dermatitis was occurring concurrent with this. I sort of hinted that skin is an important piece of this picture, and a number of studies do suggest that skin is thought to be an important mechanism for allergic sensitization, which really begs the question of whether lifestyle changes over the last couple of decades have compromised the integrity of our skin. Even in animal models, we have evidence that if you induce atopic dermatitis, that can then result in the development of further allergy, including food allergy. And so this is where the second wave of allergy comes in, which is food allergy. So based on the literature, food allergy rates seem to have increased dramatically since the late 1980s. Food allergy was certainly being recognized much earlier than this, with some reports in the early 1900s already talking about trying to use oral immunotherapy or OIT to try to treat food allergy. But there really wasn't significant interest in quantifying food allergy rates until really the 1990s. Just to share some statistics, the CDC estimates that between 1997 and 2011, food allergy prevalence in children increased by 50%, and peanut allergy rates tripled during that time. I mentioned that in our article, we found a rate of about 4% for IgE-mediated food allergy, although the current rate is being estimated somewhere between 4 and 8%, and likely the truth lies somewhere in between those figures. In terms of the immune tolerance piece, it will be helpful to think about the various factors that ultimately dictate whether immune tolerance is appropriately established and whether one is disposed or not predisposed or not predisposed to allergy. And I think it's helpful to take a step back and consider that there's an important role for genetics, environmental impacts, and epigenetics that together will dictate whether immune tolerance is appropriately established. Genetics, this part is rigid. It's our DNA. It's what we are hardwired with. It's the code that we carry within ourselves from birth throughout our entire life that is used to ultimately make the proteins that develop the or that are involved in the various vital functions in the body. And then there's the epigenetics part, and that refers to how the genes that we have are actually expressed. We do know that genetics is important. I'm just going to use an example. There's certain gene changes that are associated with increased risk of allergy, for example, in the gene filaggrin, which is a structural protein and can increase the risk of atopic dermatitis, for example. We know that there are hundreds of established genes and possible genetic sites that have been associated with allergy. And unsurprisingly, these include genes involved in immune responses and epithelial cell function. But for the most part, these gene differences associate with incremental increases in risk for allergy and are not really slam dunk causal variants. So there has to be more to the picture. And I think this is where epigenetics comes in. So epigenetics, as I mentioned earlier, refers to changes in gene expression beyond the DNA sequence. And these can be modulated by environmental factors, such as pollutants or microbial components. These include mechanisms such as DNA methylation, as well as histone modifications. And histone modifications, provide one example of epigenetic changes, refers to histones, which are proteins that are found in chromosomes and provide structural support to DNA. And they can modulate whether that DNA is more or less prone to being transcribed or expressed. For anybody who may need a refresher, the general dogma is that we have this DNA code in our chromosomes, and the DNA is then transcribed to RNA, and the RNA is ultimately translated to protein, which carries out the various functions in our body. A proof of concept and a very relevant example to epigenetics and also relevant to our discussion of tolerance is FOXP3. And this is a gene that has been shown in a number of studies to be lower in expression in allergic individuals as compared to healthy individuals. So FOXP3 is a transcription factor that's expressed in regulatory T cells, which we call Tregs. And Tregs are an important part of the immune system that ensures that we don't develop exaggerated immune responses. So FOXP3, like other genes, is amenable to these types of epigenetic changes that can occur that I mentioned earlier, such as DNA methylation or histone modifications. To underscore the importance of FOXP3, there is a condition called immune polyendocrinopathy enteropathy X-linked, or IPEX. This is a syndrome in which FOXP3 function is eliminated, and it causes autoimmunity, endocrine issues, GI issues, infectious susceptibility, and really highlights the importance of FOXP3 to preventing immune dysregulation from happening in the body. Related to this, there's a lot of interest in the intrauterine environment and risk of allergy. And I sort of alluded to this earlier. It's thought that various environmental exposures like microbial factors, diet, pollutants, can induce epigenetic changes that can then be imprinted in the fetus. We do have evidence that exposure of pregnant mothers, for example, to microbes, including beneficial commensal bacteria, can be associated with epigenetic changes that then promote FOXP3 expression in utero. Actually underlie the fact that maternal farming exposure, even during pregnancy, may be associated with reduced allergy. And there's some other things like tobacco exposure during pregnancy could increase the risk of allergy in offspring through epigenetic mechanisms. It's more complicated than this. There's dietary factors which affect the microbiome, and many other factors like maternal stress, exposure to steroids, all of which can have wide-ranging epigenetic effects, not just on FOXP3, but other genes.
Right. So, you know, the epigenetic piece, I think, is the most important piece, because when we think about the world of what the immune system does, the hardwired genes, we have 19,000 of them, and those hardwired genes could only do so much, especially when you consider that a wheat stalk protein structure has 150,000 genes. So it's this epigenomic metastable area that allows us to be very different. And again, I think this was adaptable. I think this was something that humans have always had in order to adapt to the immune environment based on whatever was in the exposome or the exposure of our world. So what pathogens were there? And so I think you're right on it, that the epigenome piece is the biggest piece, at least for me, I think it is. And the reason being is because the epigenome is modifiable by so many different things, frankly, everything. I mean, when you look at the original work with Randy Jurdle and the Agouti mouse, you know, nutrition, methyl donors was a net positive in the outcome of the fetus. whereas BPA or the chemical was a net negative on the outcome of the fetus, specific as it was meant for the agouti gene. And I think to your point, FOXP3, 4KBOX3 is one of the most important downregulators of immune overreaction. And so if something's going sideways there, that would allow whichever part of the immune system that's over ramped up to start, frankly, just going off the rails. And if it's TH1 off the rails or T helper cell 1, you're going to deal with diseases related to that, like Crohn's disease. If it's TH2, which is the version that's more related to allergy, which is the part of our immune system intended to fight parasites, then you're going to head down that allergic path. Now, speak to the tolerance development from the perspective of the T cell. So when babies are born, you know, their first exposure will hopefully be the vaginal canal and the stool that's there, and then the breastfeeding process and the skin around the breast milk. What does that do from a tolerance perspective? So the T cells are untrained, they're naive. What happens from an immunological perspective so the guests can understand what's really going on that then sends the system to what we call tolerance? Again, I'm trying to hone in on this tolerance piece because I think it's super, super important from the understanding of why things are actually going sideways.
Right. So what we have learned about regulatory T cells or Tregs is that there are actually various types of Tregs. So there are central Tregs that are created early on in life, and there are also peripheral induced Tregs that can be created in more peripheral contexts. And these Tregs are able to down-modulate immune responses. And so in the setting of allergy, where you have allergic sensitization, just to walk us through sort of a pathway of allergy development, there's some kind of insult to the epithelial barrier. That results in epithelial cells secreting alarmins, for example, TSLP. And then these alarmins will downstream activate innate lymphoid cells. There are type 2 innate lymphoid cells that are kind of like TH2 T cells. Again, TH2 is the type of flavor of T cell that is seen more in allergy. And also recruitment of other allergy cells like eosinophils and mast cells, basophils. And the downstream consequence of that is that these TH2 T cells then promote B cells making a subtype of antibody called IgE, which then can bind to different allergens and cause allergic reactions, working in concert with other allergy cells like mast cells and basophils to create the symptoms that you see in allergy. So Tregs help to steer away from those types of allergic responses. And it's thought that the context for where potential allergens interact with the immune system is very important. So if the allergen goes in through the skin, it is more prone to develop antigen. If the antigen goes through the skin, it has a higher risk of developing allergy, whereas if it goes into the gut, where it is thought that the immune environment is more of a tolerogenic environment, that can promote tolerance to that antigen.
Yeah. And Stan, I think it's super interesting. Lindsay Albenberg, one of your fellow CHOP colleagues, and I had a conversation a few years ago about emulsifiers and different chemicals disrupting the intestinal epithelial layer. And so I almost wonder, and again, I don't know how much this is provable, but I almost wonder how much of what's happening in our children is related to different protein structures or chemical structures that we're consuming through food, whether it's maternally first and then child second, that's causing the epithelial damage in the gut lining primarily. I know you're dead on it, that clearly the data is showing that the skin as an antigenic you know, the protein falling through the skin layer from a leaky skin can trigger an immune response much faster than if it's in the gut. But if our guts are so disrupted, maybe that's one of the bigger pieces. And again, I sort of fall back onto this big concern of mine in our patient population. We're sitting in a world of primary care where we see thousands and thousands of kids in our clinic. And when I started in there in 99, it seemed like it was 1 in 100 children having calmic protein intolerance or a reaction to the casein protein that's not IgE mediated. So this is not true cow's milk allergy. And now it seems like every fourth child is being placed on a hydrolyzed formula. Now, to me, the fact that these kids end up getting, you know, a version of enterocolitis where they have blood in their stools, the stools are green from fast GI transit, that means there's definite tissue disruption. To me, that seems like a major likely reason why we would have immune tolerance problems and frankly, a rise in allergic phenotypes. Would you tend to agree with that? And is there anything we know? And again, I'm pushing you a little bit on this piece because I find it to be so frustrating in the world of medicine that we're not talking as much about the cow milk protein intolerance world and we're honing in on the food allergy when I think both are really critically important.
Yeah, I think to provide a context for what you just talked about, it's important to recognize the epithelial barrier theory, which I've sort of been hinting at, which is that breaching our epithelial barrier, which is our barrier to the outside world, causes it to become leaky and contribute to allergy. And this is certainly not an area of expertise for me, but as I mentioned earlier, hundreds of thousands of new substances have been introduced into the world over the last half century. And this begs the question of whether any of them may be contributing to rise in diseases. Of course, good luck with that, given the amount of substances. and I really would like to caution us against being alarmist here, because I don't want us to have, you know, scientists says substance X causes allergy and is responsible for global rise in allergy. We're not going that direction. Right. And I think it's important to recognize that many of the studies are done on cells outside of the body, not always in concentrations that people actually see in real life. So it's difficult to translate this into specific cautionary advice. Right. And probably the dose makes the poison. But let's just consider some ways in which epithelial barrier integrity could be compromised. And this includes the gut, but also skin and lungs as well. So household detergents, these can damage connections between epithelial cells, including tight junctions, adherence junctions, desmosomes. It appears that there's data that shows altered expression of genes that are involved in gut epithelial cell survival and signaling that are affected by dishwasher rinse aid. And in particular, the component in that rinse aid is alcohol ethoxylate, which seems to have a notable toxic effect on epithelial cells. Another common detergent that's found in households is SLS or sodium lauryl sulfate, which can interfere with the epithelial barrier integrity. And there's also interest in studying various plastic forms, which can be in various products. And these come in contact with the gut, with the skin, with the lungs, and include microplastics, which bind epithelial cells but can't enter our circulation, and nanoplastics, which can enter our circulation. And then you mentioned emulsifiers. So there is interest in further studying emulsifiers in food, like polysorbate 80, for example, which are used to increase the shelf life of food. And these have been shown in laboratory studies to potentially have the ability to affect the gut epithelial barrier and promote pro-inflammatory responses. Again, the dose makes the poison, and I think the utility and the benefits of each compound have to be weighed with the potential risks. But I do agree that more research needs to be done in this area.
Yeah, I think, Stan, I think you're, you know, very cautiously stating the reality that you know, we don't have solid science because it's so very difficult to tease out one variable in this soup of variables that are being thrown at the human body. I mean, 86,000 chemicals now in circulation, in food, products that touch the skin, products that touch us through many different variables, most of which are not tested very well in humans. We don't have the precautionary principle in the United States like they do in Europe. So we sort of put it upon the person who's taking on the product to take on the risk and find out what that is. And to your point, dose makes the poison, but the dose also makes the poison based on each person's specific genomic makeup and ability to detoxify too. So I struggle with that piece of it as well, and how much of that is a part of the play in each person's risk. And I want to shift a little bit now to talk about, you know, because I think it's super fascinating when we talk about nutrition. I know, you know, you have an interest in nutrition as well, specifically through, you know, your work in allergy and EoE, but just nutrition in general. I think one of the things that I worry about, and it was sort of interesting you touched on FOXP3 so strongly, because there was a recent article in PNAS Nexus that I thought was super fascinating by Yang et al. And they talked about Treg cells in the particular space of mental health disorder. But what they noted that was that inflammasomes were upregulated specifically, and it's known that this happens during excessive uric acid production, which we see in patients who consume large volumes of fructose or large volumes of protein. And they noted that the FOXP3 activity was lowered in those patients. So I wonder, as we move forward, if one of the bigger pieces as we start to look at food particularly is that actually the refined carbohydrates and the refined highly ultra processed foods are actually driving most disease through NLRP3 inflammasomes and other pathways. Because, you know, when you looked at COVID, the two main immune profiles in COVID were NETs, neutrophil extracellular traps, and NLRP3 inflammasome activity. And oh, by the way, the four diseases that most people died with happened to be diseases of excesses in general of food plus potential obesogens and toxins of that nature. So I find that to be really, really interesting. Do you have any sense yourself as to how much food itself, and I'm specifically like the macronutrient side of food, not the chemicals and the other substrates in it. Do we have, because I know, you know, if you look at it, I'm going to just lay this other piece out there. When you think about asthma in general, when patients have gastric bypass surgeries, asthma gets significantly better within a short period of time. So we know the nutritional intake has to have some play in it. Do you have a concept of, a thought process around that?
I think that there's definitely a role for nutrition, but we're still working on teasing out the details. And thanks for sharing that paper with me on the FOXP3 Tregs and the relation to the inflammasome. So just for those listening, the inflammasome is a multi-component part of the innate immune system that senses danger signals and then leads to activation of inflammatory responses. And it does seem that there's a body of evidence that pro-inflammatory diets, such as those high in fructose, can activate the inflammasome. So I think this is an area that does require some additional attention. In the allergy space, there is general consensus, although not strong recommendations, because ultimately we need perspective and ideally randomized controlled trials to show that something is definitively helpful. But there is a general consensus that dietary diversity is helpful for reducing risk of allergy. There are observational studies that suggest, for example, that the Mediterranean diet, which is thought to be an anti-inflammatory diet, can reduce risk of respiratory allergy. So probably there lies some truth in all of this. We just need to do more research.
Yeah, and I think you're hitting on the point that that's the next piece of the pie is that when I went to medical school, there was very little emphasis on nutrition at Emory, 16 hours over, you know, the course of my time there versus a couple thousand of pharmacological. So we knew where the system was skewed towards. And I think to your point, we need to get a little bit tighter. The hard part with all nutrition research is how do you do it? To your point, you know, what you did was so good because you were able to go back and find concrete, you know, statistics in an EMR. I don't know how the heck we're ever going to do that with a dietary model. And so I think that is going to be a very daunting one. So for me, I think more of the aligning the system with trying to find answers through things like NLRP3 inflammasomes, what turns that on? Well, we can start to put the tea leaves together. I'm not too sure we'll ever get double blind placebo controlled studies in a way that really makes a difference. That's why I found the data on gastric bypass surgery so encouraging because it's an actual, it's a shift in time that we can say, okay, something big happened. What happened? Well, decrease intake of food. So that's about probably as close as I think we're going to get anytime soon. But that being said, let's shift into the part that you've somewhat talked about already, but give me, you know, your approach, Stan, to if you were, I know you have one child, if you were to go for a second and your wife, you know, is you, the person you were talking to, and I'm using this as a euphemism for the entire audience, how would you go about saying to your wife and yourself, what am I going to do to have the best possible outcome knowing the data today in my kid from a context of I don't want to see allergy enter our world? And we can talk about the LEAP study. We can talk about any way you want. I know you have all this stuff in your mind, but do you have a sort of an idea of what you would do moving forward if you take the totality of the data we have today and say, let's do this?
Yes. So it's funny that you mentioned the LEAP study because that's one of the first things that I thought about. There have been a number of efforts in the allergy space to try to either prevent or stop the allergic march. And I think we still have a long ways to go. So I mentioned a number of times earlier that atopic dermatitis or breach of the skin epithelial barrier seems to be an important component of driving the allergic march. So there have been studies looking at trying to stop atopic dermatitis from happening or from progressing. And unfortunately, in a systemic review, moisturizing skin preemptively in infants did not seem to have an effect on the development of atopic dermatitis. Treating with one type of anti-inflammatory ointment, pimecrolimus, did not have an appreciable reduction in allergy. But I do think there's still room to study the atopic dermatitis prevention angle, maybe focusing on specific subtypes of atopic dermatitis. Diet quality. So I said earlier that it's thought that diet diversity and complementary feeding may be beneficial for reducing allergy risk. So that is something that I personally would focus on in terms of trying to reduce allergy for a child of mine. And based on the LEAP study, we currently recommend that both peanut and egg should be introduced around 6 months of life, not before 4 months. Certainly children have to be developmentally ready. And other potentially allergenic foods should also be introduced around that time as well. For those who might not know what LEAP stands for, in 2015, there was a study called the Learning Early About Peanut Allergy Trial, in which peanut was introduced early to 4 to 11-month-old infants who had either severe atopic dermatitis or egg allergy. And this resulted in an over 80% reduced risk of peanut allergy in children by age 5. And so this provides the basis for our current guidance for early food introduction to try to prevent food allergy. And I think is one of the most concrete efforts that we've seen in allergy to try to prevent allergy.
Yeah. How about any thoughts about microbiome transfer from mom to baby? So is there any thoughts? I know you talked about diversity of diet. So trying to encourage moms to take lots of different fibrous foods, hopefully to feed the gut bugs that they have that are hopefully finding, you know, because one of the things I think has been well looked at from the microbiome space is that diversity is key. So a ecosystem that is filled with many, many different bugs. So having many, many different species of microbes in there, and then furthermore, breastfeeding with all the human milk oligosaccharides are in it. Do you speak to that at all?
Yes. Yeah, so in terms of prenatal or postnatal use of probiotics, for example, these have been associated with reduced risk of early life sensitization to foods. But the question of long-term effects in terms of preventing allergy are not entirely clear. That does not mean that they might not play an incremental piece in terms of reducing allergy. There have also been questions about vitamin D supplementation, which may have a protective effect against asthma, but not other allergies. But the studies are not entirely conclusive. As we talked about, diet diversity may be helpful in terms of reducing risk of allergy later in life. And there's also been a lot of interest in certain early life factors that may cause dysbiosis to happen. And dysbiosis refers to resulting in a shift in bacteria and other commensals in various microbial sites throughout our body, where the bad disease promoting bugs outweigh the friendly commensal bugs. And a number of factors have been correlated with increased risk of dysbiosis, including method of delivery. So for example, C-section as opposed to vaginal delivery, feeding with formula as opposed to breast milk, exposure to anti-reflux agents or antibiotics in early life. There haven't been large studies that show long-term effects of these factors in either increasing or decreasing risk of allergy, but there are observational studies that do suggest at least small associations. So even in our electronic health record-based analyses, we have seen some small associations, for example, with vaginal delivery and lower risk of certain allergies and avoidance of antibiotics and anti-reflux agents in the first 6 months and reduced risk of allergy. Interestingly, breastfeeding, which you sort of alluded to, can provide prebiotic and probiotic properties. In our study, we saw a higher risk of IgE-mediated food allergy when we looked at the age range from 0 to 18. But when we focused on just the first 5 years, we saw lower risk of IgE-mediated food allergy. So it's complicated, and there may be some degree of reverse causation. But I do think that there is enough compelling data out there that makes us think about the roles of these different factors in potentially driving dysbiosis and promoting allergy.
Yeah. And I think the key word there being dysbiosis, and, you know, the more, you know, this Justin Sonnenberg and many different folks doing work in the microbiome space, the key piece coming back over and over again is that the ecosystem should have a diversity that makes sense, and that those bugs are based on a profile that historically has been roughly similar for millions of years for most people. Now, when I say roughly similar, it's not that everybody has the exact same microbes, but the profile isn't one that it's highly associated with dysbiotic organisms or one that causes trouble. I think the work of Patrice Ghani is the one that I find the most interesting, where in the, he's in Belgium, and they found that the bacteria, when they get into dysbiotic overgrown state, especially the gram-negative rods, they tend to leak some of the lipopolysaccharides, the fat sugar molecules, into the bloodstream, which causes a low-level sepsis or level endotoxemia. And fascinatingly enough, not related to allergy per se, but it's very clear now that that's actually a part of the cardiovascular disease risk factors, with elevations in lipoproteins, and even now data with ApoE4 being associated. And these were all historically beneficial. When you were cut by a sword or trying to deliver a baby vaginally, those lipoproteins actually would help prevent death. And so I think a lot of the things we're dealing with now in the allergy world are holdovers from a time where these immune advantages were primarily being focused on fighting the outside world microbially. And now that we no longer have such a richness of exposure, especially when you look at data like Strachan's early work, and the, you know, third child in a family had less disease than the first child from an allergic perspective. Well, that's, you know, again, was posited that that was mostly exposure to lots of viruses and bacteria in that third kid. I suspect that we're going to find over time that the biggest piece of the research you guys keep doing and looking deeper into the space is that the immunological system is not broken by any stretch of the imagination. We're just not priming it correctly, and we've exposed it to way too many things that are making it dysfunctional, including the microbiome and dysbiosis. So I find all this stuff fascinating, and I love what you're doing.
It's very fascinating. And I was just thinking about how in animal models, if you wipe out the good microbiome, these mice, for example, will have a higher risk of allergy. Really underscores the importance of the microbiome, which really outnumbers the cells of these various commensal bacteria. They vastly outnumber our own cells and play such a fundamental role. And I do agree, it's all fascinating.
Yeah, I think when you talk to the anthropologists in this space and the folks, even in the veterinary world now, where animals historically were not known to have allergies of any type in the wild, and now domesticated animals are starting to have simple diseases of this same nature as humans do, allergic rhinitis. I mean, they're talking about giving dogs now and cats, you know, Benadryl and Claritin and the drugs for the same diseases. And partially that makes me question again, is it because we've adulterated their food and exposed them to the same amount of chemicals and they don't get enough vitamin D because they're indoors now? I mean, there's a lot of variables to this, and I think you've hit on many of them. And again, the web of design is so hard to coalesce at one single answer. Frankly, I don't think there is one single answer. I think there's many, many, many pieces of this pie. And I always fall back to, you know, if history allowed us to live very well 1,000 years ago, the closer we can get back to that type of lifestyle without allowing the infections to kill us probably made the most sense. And to your point, dietarily and avoiding chemicals and trying to keep the microbiome in good shape and all those things make a lot of sense to me. When we think about the world as it is currently, ground up, you know, choice should be a lot of the ways people choose to live their best life. But sometimes it takes a top-down approach from the government or somewhere else to get us the answers we need or give us the help we need if we're an impoverished state, especially. I tend to think of each person as a guest. If I could give you a golden ticket and you could take it to Congress or the president and ask for one thing to be changed, and they would have to do it. And I'll give you a second to think about it. Mine would be very simple. I would go and tell Congress that I want school food to be completely changed. There's no longer any processed food allowed to be served to children. It would be whole, real food served in kitchens with chefs, and the kids would eat healthy food like they did for millennia. And then at home, if they wanted to have some processed foods and things, I think that'd be fine. That's my ask, and I've yet to get my ticket punched, but what would you like?
If I can be a little bit selfish, you know, being a research scientist, I think I would ask for their support in terms of funding for the research that we need in this space to answer all the various questions that came up during our conversation. I think that we have found ourselves in a world that's really different from the world that's that preceded the notable rise in allergies. And as I alluded to earlier, it's really a complex interplay of genetics, environment, epigenetics, breaching the epithelial barrier. And we now find ourselves in this world that's increasingly hygienic, although hygiene itself is not bad, and you know, helps us be protected from potentially lethal diseases. But it is a much different world, and there are so many factors at play here that together have seemingly resulted in increased rates of allergy. And why is that? And what can we do to definitively try to prevent or stop the allergic march? I think if we could continue to formulate solid hypotheses that then inform prospective and ideally randomized trials to try to stop the allergic march, that would be very helpful. And that is the question that I would have for Congress or whoever I would be speaking with to try to get funding for that effort. There are some concrete things that I said that we can do to prevent allergy, but there's certainly more that we can do in this space, and more work needs to be done.
Yeah, I agree. And the government is not lacking in funds. It's the allocation of the funds that I find troublesome. So I'm with you. If I had your budget proposals in front of me, I'd be funding them without a question, because prevention is much cheaper than treatment on the back end. And I just recently interviewed Randy Jertl, and we talked about imprint controlled regions of the imprintome, ICRs, and how now there's a roadmap to be tested. And so there's capabilities now in humans to look at what changes methylation-wise, to your point, epigenetically in certain populations, if we can start to look at what ICRs are turned on and off, and how is that leading to disease? And in his work, he even talked about how NLRP3 inflammasome was one of the ones that popped up again as a major controller. So I think where this is going to go is where you all who are doing the great work, your MD, PhDs and the PhDs of the world who are doing fantastic research to help those of us on the clinician side of the space make better decisions for our patients. So I applaud you, Stan, for this fantastic work you've done. Your career looks bright, and I look forward to seeing your name pop up on other papers and other research. And I'm really excited to see the future in a prevention space, right? And you're doing that. So I'm going to give you the last word, but I just want to say thank you, because your work is what allows me to stay up front in and cutting edge on how to help people be the best versions of themselves and give them the best data I can. And so appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to have the opportunity to talk about our work and to have this interesting conversation with you. Thank you for this opportunity.
All right, Stan, have a great day.
Take care.
So I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Gabrushevsky. As again, it's a look into the why we are suffering from allergies and asthma and atopic dermatitis at the levels we're seeing. You know, statistically, it's high. 1 in 4, 1 in 5 patients have to find ways to mitigate the suffering of sniffling, sneezing, itchy skin, wheezing, difficulty breathing, and potentially even, you know, having a bad outcome. So it's critically important that in society we start to look at the whys, and the scientists like Dr. Gabrushevsky are doing the work to give us some understandings of the statistics as well as the why. And as stated, it's very hard to tease out absolutely, causally, what is causing the issues of the allergic march. But there are pictures up on the wall that sort of give us a roadmap as to what is potentially happening, right? So it's clear the microbiome's at play. And we've talked ad nauseum over the couple years of this podcast as to what are the upstream reasons the microbiome is disrupted, including antibiotic exposure, antacid exposure, poor quality diets, C-section delivery, the formula feeding methodology, and many others. And levers like chemicals that are hard to prove, again, causation, but boy, a lot of these things don't make sense, right? And there's some great research continues to come out about different emulsifiers, different chemicals in our foodstuffs that are causing problems to the skin layers of the gut and potentially the lungs and other places. And so we need to start thinking about this from the perspective of, do we need these chemicals in our lives? Do we need ultra-processed food, not knowing 100% that the cause of disease is from one of these chemicals, right? The data appears to me to point in that direction, that these are problems. So I always think precautionarily, I'd rather avoid them without 100% proof. Because again, they don't serve any purpose for humanity. They serve a purpose for taste and, you know, to make food easily accessible. But I don't think that is a answer to why we should be saying, oh no, don't worry about these foods because we haven't proven it yet. No, I think we should worry. And then toxins in the environment, plastics, microplastics, nanoplastics, these are all becoming question marks in this discussion. I mean, there's multiple studies showing that nanoplastics actually trigger inflammasome activation, which again causes local fires, right? And if that's in your gut lining, that's going to cause gut permeability, which will lead to potentially more problems with food intolerance and food allergy, which then again can be associated with worsening problems of allergic rhinitis and potentially asthma in and of itself. So again, Dr. Gabrushevsky clearly wants to caution against demonizing any food, which I would agree with, right? And in specifically stating that, you know, we don't have the data, but we have ideas. And for me, I lean on the, boy, we should be going as close to we can to a high quality diet that is minimally processed, that is organic, or at least minimally laden with pesticides and toxins that are, again, unknown to be truly problematical. But again, the studies sort of lean that way. So I have not found a cogent argument as to why we would not want to try and avoid these things in volume, right? So the dose makes the poison. So if you're out eating at a restaurant and you're getting regular lettuce with pesticide on it, the idea is that if it's infrequent, the probability is that's not going to cause a major problem. But again, this is all conjecture. We don't have the solid science. But the chemicals in and of themselves generally are not good for us, right? And the volume, again, is the big issue, right? And we've seen over and over again in the studies, in the basic science studies, that animal models, as well as, you know, the biomes of the world that aren't human, suffer under the abuse of toxins and chemicals. So again, I can't see how this is going to turn out to be good for us to be exposed to large volumes of glyphosate or large volumes of atrazine or these other chemicals that are being used for agriculture. Then, you know, shifting into the understandings of how the delivery mode, so C-section delivery and breastfeeding, these are all critically important. Vitamin D exposure, sun exposure, right? And so there's a lot here to be looked at that can be used to try and reduce the possibility of developing a child with allergic rhinitis or asthma and that progressing to become really problematical. So I applaud Dr. Gabrushevsky's work. He has spent time looking at some, you know, data that gives us more understanding as to where this is going. Has it truly plateaued now? It appears that maybe we're at a point where the disease onset is not going to get worse from an allergic perspective. I tend to think that's probably not going to end up being the case because of the volume of milk protein intolerance I'm seeing in clinic and then this post-COVID era, but that remains to be seen. That's my idea, it's not truth yet. So at this point, I think we've got a good 1-2 punch with Dr. Gabrushevsky and Dr. Warner looking at allergies and asthma from two different experts' perspectives, and then the underlying levers to pull on for disease mitigation. So at this point, I'm going to leave you. I appreciate everyone's time. As always, listening to the podcast, making the best decisions in life, and just truly being your best selves. It's a joy, and I thank you. So don't forget, the most important thing is always to hug those kids. Have a great day. Now for the disclaimer. The information provided in this podcast is for educational informational purposes only. It's not a substitute for advice and or treatment provided by your physician or other healthcare professional and is not to be used to diagnose or treat a health issue. This podcast does not constitute the development of a provider-patient relationship. Have a great day.